For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and gentlemen, science. It's a big word. Actually, it's only, you know, it's a short word, but it covers a lot of territory. And just about every news story that has come out and made it to the top of the charts in the past 20 years, there's some aspect of science built into it. So my question today, with science, I mean, we have science applied to COVID. We have science applied to climate change. We have science applied to human reproduction. There's a million different views on these things. And there's the ethics behind it. There's how much do we trust the science? Do we believe science? How much do we put our faith in science? That's my question for today.
Well, that's a great question. I think that's on a lot of our minds. We've heard often, frequently, right, Mark? Follow the science, you know, and that
follow the yellow brick road.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Well, if only it were that easy, right? The yellow brick road, you could look, you know, that was very clear where the yellow brick road was. It wasn't so clear where it went. But the idea, I think, of following the science is that there is a set of objective facts or objective evidence that leads one to objective truth, truth that's undeniable. I think that's what that call is. That call, follow the science, is a kind of call to action to set aside one, that sets aside one's biases and it offers a kind of pure, it's a kind of purity of knowledge. I think that's what it's trying to get at. Now, I don't think that's, what's really happening, but I think that's what is meant by it. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, you use the word undeniability, and I think that kind of gets down to it, that science plays a role in our culture of authority. You know, if you want to say something's definitively true, you can back that up by presenting scientific facts. And if you can present scientific facts, well, then we know that that's true. So science has a certain authority that I think other areas, other disciplines don't have. I mean,
Or no longer have.
I mean, you can, to a certain extent, you know, argue about, well, you can certainly argue about philosophy. We do it every week. And you can argue about theology. You can even argue about law. You know, what was the original intent of the founding fathers? I mean, all of those have a certain subjective, you know, I don't know. They're a little more
They're relegated to the subjective realm.
Exactly. Where science is supposed to be, as you said, objective. And with that, it gives an authority that if you can claim that no, this is the scientific view, what you're saying is this is the true view. So science, you know, in some ways in our culture, it becomes convertible to truth.
Right. And to argue, and of course, there's an implied penalty. If one doesn't follow the science or believe the science as it's presented, then one is a what? Science denier.
Right. You're right.
Then you really are a caveman. You are some sort of Neanderthal, you know, if you deny the science.
Right. And the problem becomes that, you know, there's not just one scientific view of just about anything. I mean, you have multiple science. I mean, the way science works is you have multiple scientists working on things from often different disciplines, from different perspectives. And so you're going to have a myriad of facts about something, and sometimes they appear to contradict. And that's honestly, that's not anything nefarious. That's not the fault of the scientists. That's not anything, you know, trying to pull something over on people. That's just the nature of knowledge, that you are going to have facts that seem to contradict. And it's sort of the job of not only scientists, but I think this is where in some ways philosophers have a role within science too, of trying to sort out what appears to be contradictory in sort of any given area of study.
Yeah, I think what might be helpful too is when we think about science, you know, scientia, you know, means knowledge, right? It's a kind of it's pointing to a certain body of knowledge. And when the term science is brought up, I think what comes to mind for most people, myself included, is you begin to, there are certain academic categories or disciplines that fall underneath the heading of science. And some of them would include physics, chemistry, biology, I would say elements of, say, medicine, computer science. Those to me would be some of the major categories that would fall into the category of science, as opposed to things like logic, where logic would fall as a discipline falls under a branch of philosophy.
Right. You know, I mean, the division there, I mean, the word science obviously is an old Latin word. It simply means knowledge. And so science originally, you go back to the Middle Ages, you know, science meant just a body of knowledge. So
right.
Law was a science.
Right.
Theology was a science.
Right.
And
the highest science.
The highest science. And the natural sciences, so the body of knowledge about the natural world, that all fell under the arm of philosophy. So philosophy was...
Yeah, Aristotle, right? It was the first to really probably exactly. capture it, right? So, you know, his physics.
Right. And then with the Enlightenment, you had a specific method that was used to explore nature. Mm-hmm. And so I think you had a change in the way the word science was used, to where science was a body of knowledge that was investigated using the scientific method.
So of the natural world.
Of the natural world, exactly.
Right.
So then science became more specifically those bodies of knowledge that had to do with the natural world. So
right.
Physics, chemistry, biology, those became the natural sciences. A lot of what we call sciences are actually arts. So, you know, so what's the difference between a science and an art? Well, a science is a body of knowledge, and art is... I guess you could say it's a body of knowledge, but it is knowing how to do something. So science is really asking the question of what, maybe the question of why. Art is asking the question how. And so arts are directed towards a purpose. Arts by nature have a telos. They have a something that you're trying to do with it. Where, you know, a science is really just kind of knowledge for knowledge's sake.
I think too, in our contemporary setting, the branch of science, I think that is that sort of permeates and saturates all of them is mathematics. So everything seems to be, there's a strong tendency to quantify everything numerically, and that's very that sort of methodology is very attractive because there's reasonable people don't disagree when it comes to basic arithmetic as to say which, you know, that the number 7 is greater than the number 6 or 5 or 4. So there's this strong desire to measure things or reduce them to numbers.
And in reducing everything to numbers, all that can come to my mind is the old Mark Twain quote. There are three types of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and, right. And I mean, you can obscure a lot. And I think the reason statistics sometimes can be seen as possibly deceitful or a way that you can manipulate things is when you're dealing with statistics, you're naturally dealing with lots of data points. That's what statistics are meant to do. Mm-hmm. And so by taking a whole bunch of data points together, you can often sort of obscure what you want to obscure and bring to the front what you want to bring to the front and sort of make things apparent that aren't really there. So there's an element of kind of being able to use science to shine a light on that aspect of the world that you want to shine a light on. And with that, yeah, then you come into biases of, you know, maybe trying to obscure and hide certain points of data that you don't want to come to light. So, you know, I think by statistics brings to bear sort of one of the biases that you can find in science, which is you can kind of pinpoint what you want to pinpoint and sort of ignore points of data that you don't want to address. But I think part of the measurement side of it is another aspect of science, and that is that it's empirical. So the natural sciences have to do with what you can measure, what you can see, what you observable. Can smell, what you can yeah. test. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, basically anything that's observable, and it may not be observable by the natural eye. You may need to bring in some instruments or whatever, but measurable ultimately means observable. So, you know, something you can measure is something you can observe. And so, you know, I think there's that aspect of science. We're talking about things that you can actually see.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you were just talking about a second ago, because I think that's a really important inflection point in this discussion about science. It's this. If I'm a scientist and I'm investigating a phenomenon, and let's say whatever that is, the occurrence of, eclipses or something like that. Well, I can gather the data, and the data it in and of itself may not be that disputable as long as I've done it thoroughly. Where the inflection point, I think, comes in, the discretion is around the judgment and decision-making about how one interprets the data and presents it, which is kind of what you were getting at. So the reason why I think that's important is because when we have an admonition to follow the science, one has to realize that whatever, you know, quote unquote, science is being presented is often going to, it requires that the data or sort, whatever is being claimed as the facts, the evidence, it has been subject to a kind of interpretation and a type of judgment to pull out the important salient things like identify, like data points don't, tell you a trend. A human being has to go in and identify a trend. You have to spot a trend. So you can use software, things like that, for trend analysis, but it takes a human. So there's always a human being involved in the science. So the reason why I bring that up is it moves, it enters into the conversation away from, or that it's a science, the science isn't 100% objective. There's always some subjectivity to it because data and evidence and fact gathering, trend analysis, all require human beings with expertise to interpret them.
Well, we're coming up on a break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about that aspect because when we talk about science, we envision kind of more of a community of scientists behind it. And there's an important reason why. But we'll talk about that when we come back from the break.
And we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we are talking science. Weird science.
Well, yeah, maybe that was probably my first encounter with the movie, that classic 80s movie.
Exactly. I always have the theme song going through my head whenever we talk science.
British accent or whatever, Australian.
Right, but yeah. we were talking about how one particular experiment may not necessarily tell you the whole story, because there's a certain human tendency, there's a subjectivity in when you look at the data points. And that brings up another very important point about science, and that is, even from its beginning, it was never meant to be an individual pursuit. So part of the idea of the scientific method was you were supposed to follow a procedure that was repeatable. And so the idea of science is that whatever procedure you use, other people are supposed to come behind so they can verify, they can bring up other data points, and nothing is ever proven until an experiment or a test or a procedure has been run multiple times by multiple people in an attempt to sort of weed out some of those biases. Now, unfortunately, as you get more, I guess, sophisticated with the instruments you've got, as you get more sophisticated with the questions you're asking, I think that gets a little more difficult. And so I think as science gets a little bit deeper, I think we run into the challenge of how do we keep science as a communal, sort of a community of scientists investigating these things rather than an individual pursuit. I think as Americans, we fall under... we fall into that because we Americans are competitive people, and I think we've added a notion of competition within science as part of, you know, just sort of the economy of science in general, that I think sometimes discourages the collaboration and collegiality of science. It doesn't wipe it out by any stretch, but I think there's certain things, the push for professors to get published, the push to be the one that makes a discovery, the push to find a marketable product. I think those things sometimes interfere with the collegiality that's supposed to be there within science. But ultimately, science is not supposed to be an individual pursuit. It's not supposed to be one science, one study proves this, and I'm going to bring my study forward to prove this point. It's supposed to be, I followed this procedure, I need other people to really verify it and ultimately to try to disprove me.
Yeah, that's the role of like peer review, and it's applicable to science and other disciplines as well. And I think that's going back to how we started the show with this, you know, follow the science mantra or command. What can be lost on us is that this community of knowledge seekers, those seeking knowledge, information, understanding, means that our ideas, our hypotheses, our theories should be not only repeatable, that's a way to verify or false or find out that they're false, but also that there's a community in which one tests and engages in argumentation, presents other ideas, other ways of thinking or approaching these things that sort of hone the whole process. So I think when follow the science, that command can kind of go afoul is if it's used as a kind of club to silence or dissuade or marginalize those who might otherwise and necessarily raise important questions.
Yeah, and I think you get into, whenever you have a community like that, you wind up with the dangers of groupthink as well. So, and especially when you're talking about science, because, you know, science, you start with experimentation, but ultimately the ideal is to create a model, an understanding of sort of a bigger picture that goes beyond just the data. But the idea is to take the data and use that data to form a model of the way a system works, the model of the way, the entire universe works. I think ultimately the idea would be to get one big whole model.
I think there are some trying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not sure if they're going to be able to do it. Because they tend to be atheists, and that right there excludes.
Oh, I don't know about that. But I think they've done polls of scientists. They've done polls of university professors, etc. And honestly, it breaks down religion-wise just about equal to the general public.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So I'm not sure that the characterization of all science is scientists as atheists is
I wouldn't say all. Correct. I just my guess would be the majority.
but you know, certainly the idea there is, and I'm going to bring up the bad guy. I'm going to bring up Hegel. The idea is that contra Hegel, they want to say that there's a definite distinction between scientific knowledge and religious knowledge. You know, Hegel kind of said, no, there's just knowledge, and religion and science are pointing in the same direction.
Right.
That's
what a good Catholic would say.
That's what a good Catholic would say too. Yep. I wonder why I keep bringing up Hegel. Anyway, that's for another show.
Right.
But anyways,
there might be a pill for that, Mark.
But as scientists are creating these models, they're doing it in community, and there are certain biases and certain dangers that come about whenever you, I think, work on a problem collectively like that. The human mind is built in a way that you bring about certain associations and things that will tend to create a model that everybody agrees with, even if not all the data points that way. And you begin to like sort of ignore certain important aspects that don't quite fit, but the rest of the model still sort of works. So we're going to keep the model, and the way our science is going to go is in a direction that tends to want to verify the model, not in a way that tries to understand the outlying points of data that might point to how that model's flawed. And like I said, part of that is just the nature of communities and how we think communally when we think together. So there's certain dangers, I think, that come about, but I don't know, by and large, I have a certain amount of faith in scientists that they're able to work around those as a community. Of course, you know, scientists are human, and so they're susceptible to all human foibles.
Well, I think one of the dazzling elements of science in our current setting is the breakthrough innovations and really remarkable advances that happen at an incredible speed. You know, it wasn't that long ago that we celebrated, or at least acknowledged, that the iPhone had been around for 10 years. And an innovation like an iPhone, you know, really has had for good and for bad, I would say, a huge impact on how we live our lives, smartphones. And so you look at a device with the power that just fits in the palm of your hand, like an iPhone or smartphone, and you can't help but be amazed of all the things that it can, all the things it can do and allow you to do, not just, you know, functions and transactions to managing elements of, say, your household and your budget and pay bills and all that kind of stuff, but the information, the social media, right? All you really can't have social media in the same way if it were relegated to a big box PC sitting on your desk.
Right. But that brings up a different question, and that is the question of technology. So because there is a difference, right? You've got science and you've got technology. And those really kind of they differ.
Well, they differ. I might put technology as a kind of as a sub branch of the scientific project. Although I wouldn't limit it to it. Actually, I'd have to think about that. Actually, technology probably has its own. It certainly relies upon elements such as you need the disciplines of mathematics and physics and chemistry and others certainly at work. But it's probably not relegated. It certainly can't be reduced to just that, because there's a whole nother. There's a much fuller dimension to technology than just those sources.
Yeah, I mean, you know, technology is really taking what the scientists have learned and applying it, doing something with it, making something with it, creating something with it. So, you know, technology is the ability to build tools, build bigger and better and greater, or maybe as time goes on, smaller and more precise tools. But it's the art of using what we know about the natural world to create tools to make human life, in theory, better. Now, that raises a question. Does technology really make human life better?
Yeah. I might also add, though, I also think you can go from, I don't know that the flow is necessary. I'm not sure that you're even saying this, that the flow is necessarily from what science knows or determines flows into technology. I actually think there's plenty of room for innovators to develop concepts. And then once you have your concept in mind, you envision, you imagine something, a possibility, you then back into it, you bring it into realization by moving science, using the disciplines of science and doing something brand new and bringing something else into existence that didn't exist there before.
Right. And not only bringing something into existence, but finding different aspects of things that we had known before and figuring out how to utilize those in a different way. So, and you know, that's part of what, I'll bring up another evil genius.
Heidegger. I knew it.
Yep.
There's only one more of your unholy three left, and it's Kant. Somehow he'll make his way in here, I'm sure.
But, you know, Heidegger pointed out, you know, technology has the ability and has the tendency to change the way we interact with things, to change the way we see things. And that, in a way, often changes the things themselves. You know, you agriculture, one of the most primitive technologies we've got, has not only just changed the way we see animals and plants, it's actually changed them. You know, we have physically manipulated the species to suit human needs. And so
GMOs, buddy.
Yeah, it's all gone all the way up to GMOs. But, you know, I mean, the art of agriculture, the art of actually changing a plant to better suit human needs, I mean, that goes way, way, way back into history, even into prehistory.
Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting, too, when it comes to how, yeah, technology permeates everything. I mean, just the other day, driving around the country, you know, there's a farmer in his big old John Deere tractor, and he doesn't have to drive it. He's sitting there. He's the operator, but it's being really driven by the onboard computer that is synced up to the satellite. And so he's just kind of, I think they're, I'm not sure what they're doing. It seems like they just kind of make sure it doesn't, you know, go off the rails or turn against them or something. You know, robots do tend to do, they hate human beings at some point. They always turn. Watch any sci-fi movie. Oh, wait. Speaking of which, we gotta take a break. Okay.
Yeah, the technology called the clock
Right. Says
that it's time for us to take a break. We'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
When it's easy to give up, don't. When it's easy to give in, hold on. When you're thinking you're about to give out, ask for help. Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell in the game with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford. We've been talking about following the science. And in this segment, Mark, I'm going to throw one at you. Here's a question. I think it's on our minds, especially as Catholic, comes up from time to time. Okay, so what's the cause of the tension, if there is tension, between science and faith?
Between science and faith. Is there a tension between science and faith? And that's the big question. Because, you know, I think if you look at the history of science, one of the things, and I'm gonna kind of demonstrate some of what we talked about earlier with statistics, that you can find different data points and shine your light in different aspects and things. But, you know, as you go back to the history of science, you find that a large number of the pioneers within science were men of faith. And a lot of them were Catholic. Gregory Mendel was a monk. You know, Copernicus, he was, I think, a priest. I think that's right. Yeah. So you find that the early scientists, they saw absolutely no contradiction. As a matter of fact, they were motivated to explore the universe and motivated to develop the scientific method to get a more precise understanding of God, because they recognized that by exploring the creation, they might be able to get a better idea of the Creator. So as you go back, you know, the tension might not be there, but why do we seem to have a tension now? I think it's because people feel like the realm of faith is explaining things that can't be explained by science. And whether or not that's true is a good question. You know, whether or not there's a sort of realm of religious truth that science can't touch, and vice versa. I think people often have the other understanding that scientific knowledge is somehow sterile and somehow not spiritual. You know, that when we explore the material world, there's no spiritual element in it, behind it, causing it. None of that's there. And so there's a distinction that's made between the sterile, material, measurable, conquerable universe and the mysterious, unknowable, unexplorable realm of God and theology. But whether that's a true distinction or not, you know, I don't know. I often kind of ponder that and go back and forth and think about that, because I think there's probably less of a tension there than most people think.
Right. I think it's a tension that can be worked through. And, you know, as Catholics, you know, we believe that there's ultimately one source of knowledge and one source of truth, and that's truth with a capital T, and that's our Lord Jesus Christ. And so ultimately there cannot be incompatibility between science and faith. And if there are apparent incompatibilities or incongruencies or contradictions, that means we need to keep working through them, because usually there's a source of there's either something we don't know yet, or there's maybe a flaw in our thinking, a gap in our knowledge, those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think there's another aspect to sort of, I guess you could say, the rivalry between science and religion, and that is religion claims what science aspires to. And I think because of that, that creates a tension there. So religion claims to have a certain knowledge of the whole. You know, religion mm-hmm. claims to kind of have a bird's eye view of all of creation, because we understand the Creator, we understand what was revealed. And so we kind of have this claim that we understand the whole. And science is moving the other direction. They're looking around the universe and trying to build up a better understanding of the whole. And so when scientists hear religious claims, they say, you're claiming things that you have no way of knowing yet. And so I think that creates a bit of a tension, that there's a claim by religion to know the whole, and then there's an understanding from science that we're trying to get an understanding of the whole through science. And I think that sometimes creates, I don't know, a bit of a rivalry or a bit of a tension or a bit of a dismissal of the claims of one or the other.
Yeah, there's often, I just think there's a lot of tendency, especially maybe in younger people too, to put their faith in science, because it seems, again, that science offers a kind of, authoritative claim to knowledge and certainty, that when juxtaposed to certain, say, religious claims, seem, you know, obvious. So you can hold up, for example, the quadratic formula delivers every single time. It seems like that you look at it and you kind of go, oh, okay, once you understand how it operates, you go, oh, look, or maybe some of the rules of algebra or calculus, and you go, okay, well, this seems to operate the same every single time. So every person who's presented with this kind of, say, mathematical problem should arrive at the same answer, and the answer is either right or wrong. There aren't multiple answers to many mathematical problems, especially basic math problems, things that are taught up to through the, say, the high school level. You can get into more speculative theoretical aspects of math, but I'm not talking about that. So we know that 2 + 2 = 4. And if you put down, if you're asked that on a test, what is 2 + 2 =? If you answer anything other than 4, you're not you put down 8 or 3 or whatever, you're going to get it marked wrong. The teacher isn't going to sit there and say, oh, well, that's how creative of you. I hadn't thought about 2 + 2 = 3. That's very innovative. Congratulations. I'll give you extra points. No, you get so. But if you bring up something and it's not a fair comparison at all, but then they'll be presented with like the dogmatic truth of the Immaculate Conception. And then you can see how one might struggle or find more difficulty without proper training, how one can find the certainty and reliability that the church's claim to the Immaculate Conception is of the same order or even higher order of truth than the mathematical claim that you might find in basic arithmetic.
Right. You know, there's a claim to authority that both stake, right? So both religion and science make a claim of authority. You know, the church says we have received the revelation from God. You know, we were founded by the apostles who lived with Jesus, saw Jesus, knew Jesus, saw Jesus crucified, saw him raised from the dead. And with that, it carries a certain amount of authority as to what that means. And then there's a great deal of thought and knowledge and wisdom that came from the early church fathers that sort of worked out what that means for human life and what that means for us. And all of that stakes a claim to a certain amount of authority. I don't understand it all. I mean, I haven't had the opportunities to think through the same problems that the early church fathers had to think through to come to a lot of the dogmatic claims. You know, I think you brought up the claim of the Immaculate Conception of our Blessed Mother. You know, that is a dogma that was declared dogmatic by the church very late in the game. Not that the early church didn't necessarily believe it, but the idea that they understood it to the extent to where they could say that this makes a dogmatic claim from the authority of the church that this is definitively true, that took thousands of years to develop. It took thousands of years for the church to kind of come to that point. And so the church has a certain amount of authority that says, because we say it, you have to trust us that we've thought through it, trust us that it was revealed to us, trust us that we know what we're talking about. Science kind of has the same authoritative claim that we're scientists, we've gone through the procedure, we're part of that community that's checked each other, we've published peer-reviewed articles on these topics, we know what we're talking about. You need to kind of defer to our expertise and trust that we have the authority to know what we're talking about. So both religion and science are making claims to authority. And I think people have a tendency to defer one to the other and kind of say, well, I'm going to follow the science rather than follow the religion, or I'm going to follow the religion rather than the science. And in truth, I'm not sure that they necessarily have to contradict.
Yeah. Well, they should. I don't think they should contradict. I think part of what can happen is another, I would say, problem that has arisen over time is certain disciplines. I'll put it this way: each academic discipline has its proper subjects of inquiry and its proper methodology to investigate those topics. And where problems can arise is when you sort of jump the shark. And here's an example. I'll break away from that for a quick second. Here's an example when let's say a very talented actor of the highest celebrity caliber, let's say, or status, begins to make definitive claims about an area of which they have no expertise. And then because of relying on their the platform of their being a celebrity, the platform of their popularity, begin to or operate in, make claims about things that they really are really probably opinions at best and uninformed opinions more than likely, but they're just sort of accepted based on the sort of status that they have within the society. And I think that's where science and religion, science and faith, I would argue, and I think a lot of really good philosophers and theologians recognize that there is no true incompatibility. But there can be though times in which we wander from or cross over where we should be staying in our lanes, and we sort of jump the shark. So when and I'll give you an example on the theological side. I think when someone reads Genesis and reads the book of Genesis with the attempt of using it as a sort of a physics modern physics perspective or set of methodologies, one will fall flat on what the book of Genesis, the truths that it contains. But it contains religious truths. It doesn't really necessarily. Doesn't have a claim to scientific truth. So the 6 days of say creation, for example, is probably the most well known.
Yeah, and I would say a lot of those tensions that we see, and you know the celebrity coming in and talking about science, that you know as you said, they're people not necessarily staying in their lane. Those problems don't stem from problems of either science or religion. They stem from a problem of a different discipline, and that is politics. So when we get
the P word.
We go, buddy. So we're going to take another break, but when we
you
come
bet
back,
we will. Let's talk to get about, more coffee.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about how politics interferes with this with this relationship between science and religion.
And we'll take that on as soon as we get back on the Catholic Cave. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we've been discussing science and the intersection of science and religion. And, you know, if you go back to the origins of science and going back to Aristotle, I think one of the things that I think Aristotle is incredibly admirable for putting Western science on the correct footing. And part of the reason why is he recognized human nature. When he started talking and unfortunately, if I told you what work this is, it would give the game away a little bit. But he starts off characterizing man, and he says, above all else, man is a political animal.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't say above all else man is a scientific animal.
Right.
Nor did he say above all else man is a religious animal. But above all else, man is a political animal. Now, he starts some other works off with other statements similarly. Above all else, man wants to know. You know, so man's desire is to know. So there's aspects of human nature he highlights elsewhere, but I think that nature of man being a political animal above all else, you can't ignore that when you're looking...
Democrat, Republican, libertarian.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't ignore the politics that comes involved. And both science and religion, the nature of ethics, the nature of politics is to utilize those bodies of knowledge, those sciences, to get your will politically, to assert yourself over other people and to use them to a certain extent as a power play. So if you have a particular prescription in mind of maybe you're a good-hearted person and you really sincerely think this will make the world a better place, or maybe you're maybe not quite so nice and this is more for your own personal gain, but if you can utilize the authority of science or religion to sway other people, you know, that's a huge temptation. And I don't think we can have a discussion of science and religion, or science or religion, or the interplay of both of them without really bringing in how politics affects both of them.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that you brought up Aristotle and politics, because part of how I've read Aristotle in that regard is he's getting at the social aspect or social nature of human beings, that human beings for and it seems obvious when you say it, but human beings, in order for us to flourish, in order for us to reach our full potential, in order for us to thrive, we need to do that together. It's better to do it together than alone. And we come together for common projects, shared values, things like that, the common good that we pursue. And so you need a kind of political order in order to identify those goals, create laws, or it's organize our efforts.
Right. But I think in that project of organizing our efforts, etc., there's power involved naturally, and
yeah, there's authority and decision making.
There's the
allocation of resources.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you have those, the tendency is going to want to claim authority, and not necessarily authority that you by nature have. And so science and religion become huge temptations for authoritative disciplines to kind of co-opt and use science or use religion to sort of enhance your authority and, you know, therefore get what you want.
Well, there's what we call corruption. So, yeah. So you have to, as you form a society, you have to, because you recognize immediately that reasonable people can have different views, different opinions, different ideas on what actions what actions to take, and what prioritization, allocation of resources, gathering of resources, all that kind of stuff. And so you do form a government and invest it with authority to settle those disputes.
Right, right. And I think, you know, in the contemporary setting, each of us has our own political views. And so the political views of scientists, I think, naturally sort of sways what they want, what they're interested in investigating. But also, I think it does affect their mode of looking at things, their mode of investigating. And finally, I think it also affects their conclusions. You know, Thomas Kuhn comes to mind, and he's the one that sort of coined the term paradigms and paradigm shifts. And
That's a classic.
Yeah, and you know,
we have to unpack things.
Right.
Let's unpack that.
Right, exactly. Right. And you know, that involves a paradigm shift. You know, we use these terms and they sort of roll off our tongue, but I think we use them in different ways than what what Kuhn really meant. But within a paradigm, you've got a certain model of the way that you see the world.
Right.
And not all of the data fits. There's no perfect paradigm, but we make allowances for things that don't fit within it until we kind of hit either a critical mass or something that's just so disruptive that it kind of destroys the whole paradigm. But there's a lot of dissonance. There's a lot of things that we can ignore, a lot of data that we can kind of set aside to still continue to utilize and continue to further a particular paradigm that we have. And so I think a lot of times in science you see that there's a particular model of the universe, a particular model of the world that has been accepted. And the contradictions, the things that would attack that model, that would attack that view, tend to be left to the side. And that's a sort of bias. It's a sort of political bias within the world of science. You don't want to be that outlier scientist that's bucking the system. I guess some scientists like being the maverick, but by and large, you don't want to be the maverick. You don't want to be the one that everybody's looking at saying, no, you're wrong. So you may ignore particular data, or you may ignore particular evidence, or you may ignore particular observations that really lead to bucking the system. And then when you move that into a political sense and you come up with evidence, you come up with data that goes against the predominant political project, I think there's even that much more pressure to kind of lay that to the side, ignore, or make less of something that you know is true for political expediency.
Yeah, it's very difficult to remain impartial and be what Adam Smith called the impartial spectator, especially of your own projects and your own work. And so you, but that seems for much of what we want to do, especially in the areas of science, but other aspects, you want to try to investigate things. You're trying to learn, you're trying to gain knowledge, you know, through information, knowledge, understanding, eventually attain wisdom. I remember because, you know, Plato points out that his great teacher, Socrates, you know, said that was one of the most difficult things that can happen is to a person is to really change how one, you know, a tenet of one's worldview, let's say, to contemporize it. This is why, you know, it's called the Catholic Cave, because we're leaning on the allegory of the cave from the Republic. And part of what happens in that allegory of the cave is when you first you climb out, you free yourself, and you climb out of the cave into the light. What happens? Well, it hurts. It hurts your eyes, right? You're not used to it. If you're in a dark room and the light suddenly goes on, there's a kind of a painful adjustment period, and that's the metaphor that Plato uses to say when you go from having just sort of a knowledge of a surfacey knowledge of appearances to true knowledge of universal concepts, the divine forms, that's a shock to the system. And I think that where that's relevant to our discussion today is that when you're, again, if you're engaged in a project pursuing something, we have a tendency to dismiss, minimize, ignore challenges to our core tenets of how we understand how the world operates, our worldview.
Yeah, and there's another aspect to that allegory of the cave that I think is relevant, and that is, you know, after Plato's prisoner has escaped and he's seen the light and he's been blinded and his eyes have gotten used to it, you know, Plato calls him back into the cave.
Right, because there's others down there.
There's others down there. And the others
that he wants to share with.
Right.
The good news.
Yeah, but they're resistant because...
Right, they won't do it.
All they've ever known are the shadows. And so there's a certain tendency to want to cling to what you already know rather than contradict that. And rather than be proven wrong. So there's sort of an element of human nature that says, I'm going to continue to investigate. So these prisoners down in the bottom of the cave, they want to continue to study their shadows, right? They want to continue to get better and better at discerning what those shadows really are, because that's all they know that they think there is. And when somebody tells them there's something different, not only is there a little bit of a distrust and sort of a lack of knowledge, but I think there's a moving out of your comfort zone and a discomfort with having to step away from what I've done, step away from what I've known, step away from the theories that I've had, step away from the worldview that I've had to look at something new and in a different way that interferes with I guess the process of coming to truth and knowledge.
Yeah, I think you see that in all sorts of aspects of our lives where we have maybe a settled position on something, and then to hear, so let's say something like pro-life. So let's say we're both pro-life. I'm sure our listeners are pro-life. So it then becomes, but it's incumbent upon us if we're pro-life and we want to evangelize others and bring others to the truth of the pro-life position, it's incumbent upon us to understand where people who disagree with us to one degree, to maybe a little degree or a large degree, what are their beliefs, and why, and to the extent that they're sincerely, you know, why do they sincerely hold to the views that they have? And you have to be able to listen to that and also empathize with it and sort of put yourself in their shoes if you want to engage in any type of conversation that conversation, especially if the point of the conversation is to be perhaps persuasive, to begin to help that person move, relinquish their hold on falsity, like pro-choice, and move into the light of the truth of being pro-life. But that can be very difficult to do, because when you hear something that is contrary to, again, deeply held beliefs, sort of the initial impulse tends to be, at least mine is, tends to be to reject it.
Right.
And move on to something more productive. But you can't always do that.
Yep. And I also think I think the pro-life issue brings in a bit of sort of the importance of having a grounding in the teachings of the church, what religion brings to bear, so that you can have an interpretive framework that really does fit with God's creation. You know, when you see, as a scientist, you see the miracle of conception and recognize it within the context of God creating and sustaining life and moving, that sort of reverence for life gets enhanced by the science, and the science enhances the reverence for life, and they go hand in hand and they work beautifully together. Whereas if you're not so well formed in your faith, I think you miss a lot. You know, I think there's a lot that goes by the wayside that, you know, you're not going to see just because you don't kind of have, I think, both sides moving to verify the same thing.
And that's what it's all about for this show, Faith and Science. You've been listening to The Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Thanks for listening. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.